Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your well-being, and the well-being of our families, our communities, our society, and societies and creatures and communities and peoples all over the world, which are all part of our total environment and are interconnected. Health and well-being and survival. So each week, the show's been ongoing for 9 years. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, policy, science, and community. And each week on the show, we discuss different facets with authors, experts, scientists, thought leaders, activists, and journalists as well, filmmakers, all different people that have apprehended some aspect of our interconnected world. On today's show, we're having a return guest who I'm delighted to welcome again. Her name is Rivera Sun, and Rivera's been on the show before with her earlier book, The Dandelion Insurrection, and The Way Between. She writes novels, Billionaire Buddha, we also discussed that, and her partner Daryl Garner was also on about that one, because it's kind of a jumps off from his unusual and interesting life story. You can find all these programs in the Connect the Dot archives if after listening to today's show you want to backtrack and catch up more with what Rivera Sun is doing. Rivera is a change maker, a cultural creative, a protest novelist, and an advocate for nonviolence and social justice. The author of the books that we've mentioned, her whole focus of her work is on making change with nonviolent action, and she has pioneered methods and written a guide about that that is currently in use by activist groups across the country.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and thank you for doing this show with such longevity and putting out the good messages of what people need to hear in the world for so long.
Well, thank you. I'm a great believer that, you know, we should be engaged, we should be involved, and, you know, we do it for the sake of the collective and for our own caring about that, you know, without knowing outcome. So, you know, we just keep doing it and build on the hopeful breakthroughs and things that happen and understandings that evolve that kind of come along and help us do a better job of it all the time. And so, you know, the show is a resource for people to hear a lot of different approaches because as you and I had gotten into a discussion about on a Facebook thread recently, you know, this is a very unique time that we're living in. You know, some people might say, oh, there are always upheavals in humankind and everything. But, you know, the challenges, the downside risks, the upside opportunities of this time for an amazing breakthrough, you know, are sometimes difficult to perceive. They may take something more of us than we even know we have to give, you know, to manifest. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the increasingly important elements is, you know, how do we approach this? How do we hold it? You know, and what understandings and ways can be helpful in supporting our positive intentions for bringing about important shifts that really benefit everyone. So that's really what we're going to be discussing today, because that really centers very much the kind of work that you've been doing for quite some time. And, you know, I'm very interested to hear what you're observing now among people and, you know, what you feel are helpful approaches and understandings at this juncture.
Yeah. I really feel like we live in a time of great change, profound changes in our world, our environment, our societies, and in ourselves. I was speaking to my 96-year-old grandmother a few days ago, and she reminded me that she was born before World War II in the Great Depression. And we were talking about the immense amount of change that she herself has personally lived through, the advent of the nuclear age, the discovery that we were causing catastrophic climate crisis, the threat that we were actually going to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons, which still looms over us, the
yes.
the invention of the internet, all of these things, and so many more, the civil rights movement, the women's lib movement, many of the defining factors of my own life are changes that she lived through. And it really made me reflect at how incredibly adaptive humanity is and how easy it is for us to forget how much we can change. That when I think about the changes we're living through right now, I'm not actually convinced that they're any greater in scope than those my grandmother has lived through. And that we can do this. One of the things that I think really helps us when we're looking at a time that we consciously see and perceive as involving lots of change is to make that part of the story that we tell ourselves about our purpose and our meaning and our experience as human beings on planet Earth. That a lot of times we have a lot of resistance right now because we kind of subconsciously bought into the consumer capitalist culture, that we were going to be able to just, you know, work our day jobs and then sit back and consume in the evenings and have this so-called good life, quote unquote. But is that really what it means to be human? It certainly doesn't seem to be what it means to be human in these times, where so much of our time when we're not struggling to pay our bills is by necessity caught up in being part of movements for change, movements that are defending our rights, our existences, the beingness of our very identities, protecting our planet, making changes and challenges to these status quo systems that are very much built on domination and conquest coming out of hundreds of years, thousands of years, really, of history.
Mm-hmm.
So the story that we tell ourselves matters for how we experience living through these times. These are adventurous times. They're not like Jane Austen kind of times. These are times when we feel the intensity of the mythic quest. We feel the dangers all around us. We feel the depth of needing to have those profoundly good friends and that profound sense of purpose and focus to get us through the darkness, to get us through our very natural fears of what we're up against.
Mm-hmm. You know, as that's really beautiful, and I think it really frames you know the full range of opportunities of this time. You know, so thank you for that. And also, as at the very tail end there, with what you were saying when you said the profoundly good friends. You know, a photograph that I saw last night on Facebook came looming up into my mind's eye right when you said that, which was seeing the incredibly glowing faces of four people who are long-term activists whom you and I both know. I know I have had the good fortune to work with them on, you know, some of the initiatives that have been necessary to do in the past. I'm sure you have as well. And I'm speaking of Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeith, mm-hmm. who recently were part of a group who occupied the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., in an extraordinary act of courage that, you know, basically preserved the integrity of the current Venezuelan government from a takeover by our own government here. And, you know, I, on the one hand, I don't know if there's any precedent for any people of any nation stopping that nation from, you know, doing a bad move, a very bad move that would harm, you know, a whole society and many people, and not be and be bad for the society doing it as well. But the reason that they came to mind was they looked aglow. They looked like they had, you know, kind of that they were seeing immense possibilities that you know, we don't often see caught up in the day-to-day and dealing with the ups and the downs and the wins and the losses, you know, of this kind of ride through these times for those who are paying attention to the various things that are going on. So, and it also looked like they were, in fact, sustained by friendship. I mean, that was the other feeling I had, which immediately came up when you were just describing this. And I don't think anyone else has mentioned the importance of friendship and of community around these endeavors, you know, and kind of talked of it consciously the way you're doing.
Yeah, I feel like that's a wonderful example of meaning and purpose in these times. Also, that we're very social animals, the human being, that we really do make some of our greatest acts of courage in not necessarily community only, but in community of friends. It's built into us. If we look at all of our myths throughout all of human history from many diverse cultures, we have the great heroes, of course, but we also have what we call the sidekicks, who surprisingly often end up playing pivotal roles in actually getting that heroic quest to succeed. I'm thinking about Frodo and Sam on the side of Mount Doom in Mordor, that, you know, if Sam hadn't picked up Frodo and carried him up the slope, Frodo could never have thrown the ring into Mount Doom's cauldron of fire, right? This is an archetype of what we experience every single day and what the role of friendship does for us every single day. And we take turns in real life being the Frodo, being the Sam. And, you know, we need to unveil this mythic dimension of our lives and reinvigorate that sense of understanding what we are doing and what we're up about. And that's what story can do for us. This is the realm that I work in a lot, is looking at archetypes and mythology and how that is playing out in our real world in terms of nonviolent struggles and campaigns such as the one you described with Kevin and Margaret. I mean, what a classic underdog maneuver to say, you know, Venezuela deserves its own sovereignty. You don't have to agree with the Maduro government. You don't have to like Maduro or the other guy. You can say, however, that the U.S. has no business meddling in other people's countries, and that we as U.S. citizens have the responsibility to stand up with all of our human courage and all of our frailty against the juggernaut and the monstrous beast that is our imperialistic war machine.
Recently, I posted something to the effect that, you know, I'm not a big fan of watching TV news because it's corporate news, you know, and we're being spoon-fed, and I, you know, constantly am beating this drum because people have become addicted to it, they've invested their trust in it, and it's a really kind of hard and surprising thing to say, gee, this isn't trustworthy. It could be shaping my understanding, even though it's what's out there and we all, you know, have agreed to it, like to give it the power of consensus belief when we know that, you know, it is funded and shaped by vested interests is unwise in terms of one's cognitive understanding of what's going on now. And then there's also the dramatic side, you know, the stories we tell, the dramas, and how they shape our inner expectations, you know, of what is possible for us, or the way things happen. Like these more mythic stories of the kind that you tell are actually also incredibly powerful in, you know, kind of supporting us in doing the things that will lead our whole collective, you know, further affirming a life path rather than a destructive pathway, you know, versus, you know, kind of becoming inoculated with expectations of defeat or domination, you know, as an inevitable. Because, I mean, as you say, you know, it's kind of like, it's like the dominating model when you become kind of accustomed to it, how do we escape it? You know, how do we transform it? And what you're saying is that we do it, in effect, through relationship and through friendship and through collective responsibility.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. How did you awaken to that? Or, like, how? What do you see as the kind of growing edge of that right now?
Yeah. Well, as you were speaking, it made me think a lot about a project that I've launched recently called the Nonviolence News. And it really grew out of my fascination with the fact that many of us are afraid to stop watching the corporate news because they've really convinced us of their monopoly on their importance, that they are covering the real issues. And if you don't watch these, then you're not up to date. But the reality is that if you follow the resistance news and go to places like Kevin and Margaret's Popular Resistance or the solutionary version of that, which is Yes Magazine, understanding that all news has bias and being aware of what perspective people are reporting from. But if you follow the resistance news, you often get far more education on what the problem actually is connected to the very life-affirming, very empowering bit of information that corporate media intentionally leaves out, which is what you can do about it and what people like you are doing about it. So years ago, I stopped following the news and on the corporate media sense and started paying attention to what activists were doing. And it completely changed my view of the world. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with the Nonviolence News is to illuminate this incredible strata of our world wherein people are taking courageous action day after day. They're coming up with viable and effective solutions to our most pressing problems day after day. We're actually succeeding as movements far more often than we ever realize, even those of us who are in the movements. I get to report on at least 6 to 12 victories every single week. I find 30 to 50 stories of people taking beautiful, bold, strategic, nonviolent action each and every single week. And when you start to see this, you start to understand that our world is so much more and so much more interesting and so much more hopeful and empowered than the narrative that we're getting through the corporate media.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I think that's so important because also to find that courage, I mean, we need role models. And, and role models of people who are doing it or who know how to do it, they're like food. They're like medicine to the inertia, the fear, the contraction that, you know, we have to, like, keep our head down and we can't do this or we can't do that. And, you know, we can only sort of submit because that's the way it is and nothing's perfect or whatever. Yeah, we need those models, and they exist. I mean, there's just some extraordinary people. I mean, I had a really bizarre experience last week, which was that I have done a lot of reporting on fracking, drilling, pipelines, compressor stations, you know, all the fossil fuel development stuff has been part of my beat for a while, and I'm connected to, numerous activist communities and groups on different fronts. Well, but yet I'm reporting lately a great deal more on other things like food and agriculture, so I'm not, like, just hawk-watching over every single development in, you know, my longstanding fossil fuel beat, and I'm not sometimes aware of stuff. So last week, and this is quite unusual for me, I spontaneously felt like fasting. It's never happened before, to be perfectly honest. I'm not somebody who, I have friends who, oh, I'm going to juice fast. I'm not one of those people. So, so I spontaneously began fasting, and then I learned that a group opposing a pipeline through New York Harbor of, you know, colleagues and allies was actually doing a hunger strike in front of the governor's office. In opposition to this pipeline. And so then I thought, well, I've never heard of a virtual fast, but my body chose to fast simultaneous with this, so I'm going to continue with it. And I did. And then a couple of days in, I broke the fast because my body was like, ouch, I'm hungry, you know, and, you know, whatever you're drinking isn't doing it, and I now need to eat. So, you know, I ate, and I found out that when that, and I felt like, oh, that's so, you know, I couldn't continue with the fast, whatever. But then it was like, oh, my gosh, they stopped the fast because they stopped the pipeline. And, you know, we don't know if they have internally stopped it, but it's been put, you know, the stop button was pushed, and their action, you know, attained the stoppage, the delay, you know, that gives more time to stop it altogether. It was a terrific victory, very uplifting. You might want to cover it in your thing. And the funny thing is that I bet you have. That was a major feat. You know, and the odd thing was I found this way to participate even though I wasn't nearby to attend it at all. So it really, you know, it's like somebody might kind of virtually participate in something and then following it get the courage to physically go and be present, or vice versa. You may have been at many marches. You can't go to this one, but you can you know, participate through caring and keep going back and forth between, you know, those doorways so that you can be paying attention and participating in different ways at different times and have a continuity of participation.
We can't all be the frontline activists on every single struggle that we're up against. We have hundreds of struggles going on. But we can think about ways that we can be participant, either in support roles or in solidarity actions. One of the most important things that we need to take care of right now individually is actually to put our lives in alignment with our principles. And this takes work. It takes dedication and focus, and I'll say the word sacrifice, but every sacrifice comes with an opportunity, a gaining. For me, that has to do with making choices around trying to support local food and not flying all over the country to do too many speaking gigs, whereas that opens up opportunities to do radio shows or to do Skype and online conferences. That every time we give up a practice that's rooted in a culture and a civilization and a way of life that we know we must transform, we get an opportunity to step into the very world that we're dreaming of creating. And that, to me, is a very mystical process. It's very mythic. It's very profound. It's something that we have to remember that humans have been doing for all of our existence, that what we're being asked to do is not outside our scope of possibility. I really love that story about your fasting and the mythicness of that one of the things we're having to do right now is to reintegrate the intuitive, the mythic, the spiritual, not just the religious, parts of being human that were discounted by the colonization and the conquest and the evolution of capitalism throughout our world, that really taught us to value certain parts of our being. And I should throw patriarchy and hierarchy into that list as well.
Definitely.
So those patterns taught us to value certain parts of our human beingness and to devalue others. But we're finding that we've gone too far in that direction and we need to rebalance. Otherwise, we're simply not going to have a chance to be human on this planet much longer.
I think that's very real, and I concur. You know, in the same, I mean, I have deeper and long ago roots in, you know, the mythic and mystical side of things, which, you know, for many years as a reporter in a male-dominated profession, which is what journalism is, you know, I put that aside in order to use my left side of my brain and convey cognitive understandings, to be clear, to be credible, to be verifiable, and all of those things that journalism demands. And I also did it so that women would not feel that we are you know, sort of stranded in the feeling and the intuitive and the caring, and mm-hmm. you know, without a voice, and that we had no bridge and no way to participate in the social decision making and critical policies of our society in a way that would favor a healthier, more caring world, you know, but that we were kind of cut mm-hmm. out of that because we had not developed these more left-brained, you know, kind of attributes. And so I kind of was like, okay, I have them. I've had the education to have them. I'll be a bridge for that. But what I've been feeling lately and doing also more of for the last year or two is really, you know, if we're just having what is essentially a sort of clever, intelligent, left-brained, and more masculine discourse, except, you know, if we're talking about Me Too or something like that, then it's really that, you know, we haven't really integrated, you know, our full selves into the whole conversation. And I don't think, you know, I really feel strongly that that those fuller aspects of ourselves are really a resource, a sustenance, and connect us to others in a way that makes these struggles and the challenges that we face more doable because we are doing them together. I think a lot of, you know, the reason why people feel like, well, I can't change this and I can't change that, and is because, you know, we have constructed these very isolated individual lives of survival and, you know, success, survival, or failure. That's how our society has scoped all of that thing out. And so then the idea that I could participate in social change means that I somehow have to do it and I can't change everything mm-hmm. at once, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you realize it's a communal thing and we help each other do it and we do it, you know, we make progress with that, then it's less intimidating.
Yeah,
and more doable.
This is one of the major story patterns that is rapidly and beautifully shifting right now. And an author who writes very eloquently about this is Sharon Blackie in her two books, actually, If Women, Rose Rooted, and The Enchanted Life. And she speaks about the hero quest mythologies and research of Joseph Campbell. And mm-hmm. says that the one adaptation that she feels that we can add to that beautiful layout that he does is to understand the hero's journey as a collective journey, that rather than thinking of Odysseus on his own or Frodo mm-hmm. on his own, mm-hmm. to understand that there is a whole archetype of collective work together, that we solve our problems. And this is something that I drew on. I have a new book coming out called The Lost Heir, which is really, it's written for all ages, but it also is written with the younger generations in mind, knowing that they need these kind of powerful stories that we've been talking about. And in the book, a young Shiro, a young girl, discovers that to change and transform the injustice, the grave injustice that she sees before her of exploited labor and environmental destruction, she needs to work with others, that she herself cannot do it on her own, that she needs to gather her friends and build relationships and speak with those who need to make a shift in their world. One of the things in real life that we struggle with in our movements is the sense of, if we just put out the flyer, everybody will do the change, right? Because it makes sense, without recognizing that in past history, organizing has involved direct outreach, direct asks, repeated connections to people, that kind of very engaged recruitment efforts by which your mother, your neighbor, your colleague, your coworker feels that you care enough about them to work with them to be a part of the change, to support the boycott, to be willing to go on strike, to change our consumer patterns, to organize not just our family, but our entire church to eat less meat because of climate change, whatever the thing is. That this idea of shifting from our lonely struggle, which is very much an idea that was developed to support, particularly in recent eras, the idea of consumerism. There's a direct relationship between the idea that we all need our own TV and computer and mm-hmm. and refrigerator and toaster, in order to atomize the family and get us to buy more. So we have to deconstruct that because we know our levels of consumerism are not going to work, for ourselves, our economies, our planet, and we need to come up with a different model, and we can. And this model is rooted in collective work, in sharing, in communities, in having tool libraries instead of our own woodsheds full of, you know, all the same wrenches and screwdrivers and machinery. In being willing and able to ride share, all these sorts of things that help us use our human capacity to build community, to take care of our community and take care of our needs. And this goes everywhere from your family and your neighborhood all the way up to our global society.
Yeah, that's really terrific. That's really amazing. One of the things that has always kind of jumped out at me as a phrase is, you know, on blogs or in other places where, there's somebody who is engaging and has the wherewithal to engage in, a kind of very high degree of conspicuous consumption or luxury, or, you know, to the point of, you know, some, just in the same way that, you know, corporate CEOs are paid like hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, for something, then you also, you know, have people who are indulging in some incredibly bizarre vanity, like, for example, the recent metropolitan benefit that they have every year, where it looked like something out of Roman times, you know, with all of these celebrities dressed in these very costly and bizarre, to my eye, outfits, you know, various kinds, vying for attention, and, you know, and it's like all the resources that went to that, you know, when, I mean, it's just really incredible. But if you engage with people who are still kind of accepting, you know, the common, you know, kind of corporate capitalist consensus around something like that, what they will frequently say is something like, it's her money and she can spend it any way she wants. And so this actually, I mean, this is an example of what you're talking about. It's like a value that's been embedded. And, you know, once someone says that, conversation closed, you know, oh, yes, you know, we've all agreed to that, you know, rather than people having, you know, popping up and saying, please donate it instead to affordable housing in San Francisco where there's a crisis going on, or, mm-hmm. No, it's like, where did that money come from and how did the celebrity wind up with all of that? It's because of our giving our attention to them. Are they expressing values that feel copacetic to us? So, you know, it's like there are these truths that are not true, that have been embedded, and that, you know, mm-hmm. and everyone has kind of accepted and agreed to, and we need to question more of them. We need to, and I think for that you also need community. You know, you need people that you trust, that you can talk with, you can express, you know, what's occurring to you, try things out, and, you know, kind of see what other folks feel about it, you know. And actually, interestingly, I think that women have long had, I mean, that's been, you know, part of, you know, the female kind of survival mechanism is doing that. And I think more men are doing it now, too, where, you know, there's like kind of circles of friendship and honesty where you can both explore personal things, but you can also come to understand and reveal to each other, like our collective buy-in, you know, to some of these things that are kind of unhealthy, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, these are themes that I've explored in all of my novels because fiction gives us a chance to look at alternate realities, alternate worldviews. In this latest book, The Lost Heir, we have two very different cultures. You have the Mariannans who prize wealth the way that many of us in the U.S. have been taught and trained to think it's individual, to think it's right for a certain elite class to amass great wealth at the expense of the people who actually produce the wealth, the workers, the suppliers, the whole network. And then to contrast that, I posited a society that values honor and connection over personal wealth, that actually sees having wealth when any member of their society is hungry as a mark of shame, as something that lowers the thing that they actually prize and value. And it's only when we run up against concepts like this in, you can find them in history, you can find them in fiction, you can find them sometimes in movies, it's only when we recognize a pattern outside of what we've been trained in that the illusion of our propaganda is broken, that we kind of wake up from the collective dream that is actually a nightmare. And we start to realize that, wow, if we want to change this, we need to do it daily, every moment of our existence. We need to it's like an old-fashioned switchboard. You have to literally unplug the neural networks that have been plugged into those old patterns and rewire them to a different way of being in the world. And it is not easy. That's why your comment about community is spot on. We need that community to help us make this shift, to reinforce the validity of making these shifts, to have it sound reasonable, just the same way that our sociopathic behaviors of amassing concentrated wealth to the detriment of the well-being of our actual society has been normalized in our society. We need to denormalize that and normalize the kind of values which we espouse, the very things such as equality for all, justice for all, that we love our people and our country. If we loved our people and our country, we would not allow homelessness to continue. We would not allow our healthcare system to continue. We would not allow our military budget to absorb over 60% of our discretionary budget when we're slashing the things with which we care for our very own children, our very own mothers, our very own elders in our society, our schools, the well-being of our people. These are why stories matter so much. If we want to change our real world, we have to work with our stories by which we construct the architecture of this immense structural problem that we're up against, and systems and structures that we are up against. It's very much the levers of change are rooted in the stories that we tell and live, the stories that we live as well.
Yeah, that is really true. You know, it's funny because, you know, there's been this whole thing of the past, you know, the New Age concept of, like, you know, I can create my own reality, you know, through my beliefs or whatever. But, you know, even as, I mean, the big problem with that was that, you know, even as people were declaring that, they were actually pouring their intentions into the same old cups of, you know, material success and fame for the individual, of, you know, of my company or my idea will, you know, whatever, take over the world. And, you know, I mean, it was like, so it was so kind of cognitively dissonant to be declaiming, you know, that you have this absolute power to do this, and yet the goal was always posited as a small individual goal, and also the whole structure was used to, you know, create a kind of protective, you know, eggshell or bubble around the person so that they didn't have to come in contact with the fears and the failures and the harm and the, you know, the injustices and problems of what we were actually doing, you know, by kind of becoming immune through using, you know, your power of intention to inflate yourself in some kind of way. So it was like, you know, it was so strange, and yet that was defined as spirituality. So the notion that your positive intentions don't just kind of hierarchically extend up out of your own being, but they actually spread in like ever widening, you know, open-armed circles to include what other people are experiencing and suffering, to allow that to modify your own sense of self and your projects, your project, like what you're doing and what you have done and what you're about and everything, actually opening to that rather than fearing it and closing, which is, you know, the basic bottom line of that is when we see it in racism and exclusion and, you know, all of these various divisive hostilities, you know, that are surfacing in our time. And I guess that brings the question, would the work, as you're defining it, also be helpful to people who are, you know, very caught in othering other people as the source of the problem?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, when I talk about changing the story, changing your story, changing our story, it's important to remember that this worldview is rooted not in individualism, but actually in interdependent and interconnected webs of being, that human beings are actually ecosystems connected to other systems, that we do not exist on our own. And the old adage, we are not free until all are free, is not just a nice saying, it's a literal reality for how we exist. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. actually speaks incredibly eloquently about this phenomenon, that he speaks about how he cannot be what he is meant to be, and I cannot be what I am meant to be until we are each what we are meant to be. And when we remember this, we can't have a society. A society isn't rooted in justice until that justice actually extends to include all members of our society. And that doesn't leave out the traditionally marginalized groups in our societies today, nor does it leave out those who are doing the oppression today, that they too have a change that awaits them, a change that, from my perspective, will probably help ease some of the deep woundings that they themselves as oppressors carry. And when we can remember this as we work for change, whether that's on a Facebook comment thread or it's in a mass movement for change, or it's the lens you direct at some of the worst offenders on our scene today, the ones that are the hardest to look at with compassion and understanding, that trigger the most valid fear reactions in us, when we remember that there really is no planet B, there is no little island that we're going to send these people who are so dangerous to other people off to, that we're going to have to find solutions and strategies that make pathways of change for each and every single one of us. And that may sound impossible, but actually human history bears us up. Human history has a robust archive of nonviolent struggles, transformational movements, true stories of people, how they've done 180-degree flips. There's this incredible group called Life After Hate, which is organized by former white supremacist gang members, basically, who had these moments of awakening. Their stories are all a little different. And now the work that they do in the world is reaching out a hand to people, to others like them who are still trapped in those patterns of hate, because they know from their experience that hate meeting hate doesn't do anything. You can't hate groups into oblivion. It just doesn't work like that. You can structurally limit their ability to cause harm, and that's very important work. But if you want to end hate, you have to go and understand why a person might adopt those views to begin with and what might get them to shift those views. And oftentimes, what this group says anyway from their experience is that they were having a deep yearning for respect and understanding. And the first groups that came along and offered it to them were white supremacy groups. And if we want to change that, we need to find ways to reach out to those who are feeling marginalized from their perspective for whatever reason, and say there is a whole worldview and a whole way of being in the world with which you can step into a great deal of respect, a great deal of understanding. But you're going to have to put down some things like your fear of people who don't look exactly like you, things like your willingness to believe scapegoating attitudes that are being promulgated by corporate media as propaganda that reinforces the ability of ruling elites to profit off of our hatred of one another. And these are things that, you know, I say this, and we're saying this in a framework of about white supremacist groups, but in many ways, there's a lot of things that in this that we ourselves, no matter where we stand on whatever political spectrum, could sit down and think about. There are plenty of people that I am very tempted to villainize, to demonize, to hate. And there's plenty of people out there, corporate media, I'm looking at you, who are actually profiting from perpetuating these beliefs. You know, our two-party duopoly, that is how they remain in power without actually having to meet the needs of the people, is by making us so afraid of the other side of things that we keep accepting inferior standards of change. So I feel like in all of this, these are the central heart challenges of our times, the central things that we need to dig to the roots of. It's no secret that I am a social radical. I get to the roots of things. I really like to dig underneath what we're being told and look for ways forward. And it's not easy. It means lots of people are not going to see your views the same way right off. But this is the work that each and every one of us is being asked by our times to grow into. The work of profound transformation. I believe it is the very work that stands a chance of not saving our civilization, because the way we live must change, but saving our very humanness, and in that humanness, our privilege, our unique privilege as human beings of being alive on this beautiful, beloved, and imperiled planet. If we want to be here, then we're going to have to step up to the game.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, when you think about it, it's the greatest, you know, the greatest drama opportunity, and yet, we've become kind of neurologically sedated to, you know, kind of follow along with the program. And yet, you know, making that kind of shift is calling forth the best in us, if we can answer that call, you know.
Those stories really matter so much, you know, like Game of Thrones is so popular right now. And there are archetypes in that really we can draw upon, but to dig deeper than what's at surface value, and to look for stories that not only call out the problems that we're facing, but also embody the solutions and the kind of characters we're hoping to grow into. This is the work that I do in all of my novels, because I see it as being so essential. Each and every one of us can look back to our young years and find one or two characters out of books or movies that, you know, kind of haunted us in a role model way. For me, it was the woman warrior. I'm 36 years old, and I grew up in the time when that was feminism, is to put a sword into a woman's hand and have her go off and, you know, be as good as the guys. And the idea of healing and transformation and nurturing and the integrated path that we were speaking about earlier, that wasn't as present. And I think we've come a long way since those days. We have the ability to tell more nuanced stories. I look at books like Akata Witch by Nnamdi Okorafor, and I'm just so impressed by the many archetypes that book can embody, and the many stories that it offers to us as role models. I think we need to be very questioning around mass media and the role models it is presenting. We have a situation right now where the military is considering expanding the draft to women. And many of our movies for young women, particularly teenagers, feature female assassins or soldiers. I mean, I can just rattle them off. The Hunger Games, Hannah, Divergent series. The list actually goes on from there. Wonder Woman in many ways. And while those are all models of a certain kind of empowerment, they are also models that serve an imperialistic warmongering worldview. And we need to be questioning of those. That's why one of the works that I do in my novels is really to posit the nonviolent alternatives, to draw upon the robust and effective history of nonviolent struggle and build stories that show how we can use that, how people really do use that in our world. Because the idea that violence is where we get our power from is very limited compared to the many sources of shared power, power together, power with, that we can tap into.
Yeah, wow, that I completely agree. I mean, I personally haven't watched and don't know the plot of a single one of the ones that you've mentioned, actually, because I'm not of the generation that's, like, into them. And, you know, I don't like that they're doing that for exactly the reason. You know, it's like that is not, you know, women to be heroes don't have to, or anyone to be a hero, you know, we don't have to embody, you know, the killing model as the ultimate power. That's a very, you know, really, it's like placing us on a very destructive trajectory to take that. And I say this as the, you know, daughter and granddaughter of veterans and warriors and people, you know, who were in famous battles and all the rest of it. And, you know, the repercussions of war in the family system where the women and the children and, you know, the aged parents and everyone have to cope with a shattered, you know, human who has been conditioned out of normal caring human responses in order to kill. This is nothing to put on a pedestal and emulate in order to belong, to be powerful, or, you know, or anything else. I mean, it's like just but yes, that is exactly, you know, the problem. I mean, every time we approach mass media in any form, be it news or dramatic, you know, we have to understand, I mean, this is my understanding, having worked in it for 40 years or whatever, you know, we have to understand we're being programmed. The whole goal of it is to program us, you know. And so it's an incredibly, it's like you're succumbing to the oppressor if you allow them to program your dreams, to shape the possibilities of your reality, to limit the mystical scope of where your own natural wisdom might take you. It just, you know, I really counsel people not to do it. I mean, just to give one example, you know, and people are much clearer when they don't buy into this. You know, I have a, you know, a kind of young person in my community, a young man, and he, you know, is into all the war and the fighting videos and games and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, what, like, I worry about it. What is that setting him up for, you know? It's inoculating feeling. It sets him up to be a killer and to be dissociated and, in effect, sociopathic. That's not his natural tendency. That's not who he is. So, you know, I was looking for every way possible to interrupt that, you know, and, you know, kind of take him out of that and take him into other spaces. And it's really interesting because through doing that, this silent person that was, like, just invested in these games began becoming visible as a kind of change maker personality, you know, as a creative. There's so much more inside him that to be liberated from that path. And I believe that that is true of everybody and true of all of us. And, you know, but we also need, I think, the voices of elders and wise people, you know, kind of telling stories as you were doing, and also saying, you know, with the weight of a kind of caring moral authority, you know, this is not what we do as people, you know. And part of the denigration of the feminine is also denigrating that voice, you know. So, you know, we need those voices, mm-hmm. and we need to be connecting to give the kinds of teachings that you are giving, and that, you know, I'm giving, and the guests on the show are giving. You know, we all have that to give, whether through creative works or in families or in community. And, you know, people with that wisdom, you know, used to have a seat, and that seat has been undermined. We need to take that seat back and occupy it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think about that for my sister's children. One of them is a young girl, and thinking about the stories that she's going to grow into that have been put out by our mass media is really what inspired me, as you did with your young friend, to do an intervention and to suggest a different story. Me, quite literally, with the novel series, The Lost Heir and The Way Between is the other one in that series right now. But you, in terms of taking a young person by the hand almost and saying, I want to know more about you. I want to know more about mm-hmm. who you are and who your potential is, because what you're being told that you can be is not, as the slogan goes, be all you can be. There's so much mm-hmm. more in there. Mm-hmm. And it is people like us and people like your listeners who really are the ones who are going to make that change, who are going to say, wait a minute, what is this nightmare that we're living? How can we wake up, and how can we start to make that change? We're using all of our human beauty and power and strength.
That's right. Well, we're coming to the end of our show. I'm sorry for the conversation to end, because it's such a wonderful conversation that you and your work have opened up. You know, it's really a wonderful and such an important conversation, and such an important avenue. That's a really a resource avenue, and we need that. We need that, and this is a really beautiful one, and really deeply, deeply appreciate it. So thank you, and thank you for coming on the show again. We won't wait so long to have you on again. I've loved talking with you and hearing from you, and then there's a book that you're about to, you know, bring forth right as we speak. It's launching, and, you know, where will people be able to find The Lost Heir?
Yes, absolutely. That's a funny phrase, finding the lost heir, but you can do that. It is available on all the major online bookstores. You can special order it through your local bookstore if that's your persuasion, you like to support them. If you like to support independent authors, such as I am, my books come into the world through a whole community of people, and you can find them on my website, www.riverasun.com. That's also where you can sign up for the free e-newsletter of Nonviolence News, if that part of our conversation today intrigued you. And I would just say that, you know, as someone who, I say I'm an independent author, but then I always like the joke that I'm an interdependent author, and that people find out about my books through people like you, Allison, and people who are willing to go talk to parents and teachers and schools, who connect with radio shows and reviewers. It really does take that whole village to make sure the messages of peace and nonviolence and a diversely and multi-pronged sort of embodied feminism gets out into the world, into our young people's hands. So the more the merrier as far as finding out and talking about these books go. Thank you so much for being a part of that and for this incredible conversation that is so profound and meaningful as we all navigate this time of change.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's kind of funny, because what this conversation has a lot of the characteristics of friendship, you know, and I always like to have that wherever it shows up, you know, honestly, almost anywhere. But it is, it's like being a true friend, and finding true friends and participating in that in a way that is also nourishing, you know, the ongoing human community here on Earth, you know, as part of the focus. And so, and I think it actually deepens friendships when that's something we share. So, you know, we're having trouble getting off the air. So thank you all the listeners for being here with us today on Connect the Dots. We've been talking with Rivera's son. It's been a total pleasure. I can't wait to read The Lost Heir and track with all that you're doing. And thank you for being on Connect the Dots. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. We will be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And, like, you know, stand tall, keep marching forward with all our friends and all our relations.